Yes, sir, we promised you a great
Gorgeous
event.
Gorgeous George, here we come.
Andre, the Giant.
WrestleMania!
The Right Hook is a Pantsless Aggression production.
Do you like parties?
Yeah.
We can invite all our friends and have soda and pie.
Yeah!
I hope no bad people show up.
Disregard that, Frank. It's a bunch of liberal bullshit.
Been alive and see the talk for the rock still. From the streets to Shanghai back to Knoxville. Sitting high on a mountain rock. Hold the top, spreading the good news. Been a lot of false prophets and quick hits. And a lot of un-American bullshit. But the time has come to settle and the devil's gonna make you choose. It's just like a cold wind blowing. Can you feel me coming to you? Just like a freight train rolling back tight full of rhythm to blues.
Broadcasting live from AltCon East, get ready for your 60 minutes dose of sucker-free conservatism you've come to know and love as The Right Hook. I, of course, am your host, the Rated R Republican, the social media messiah, blogger without a cause, and not only a voice for the voiceless, but the heart and soul of YR's nationwide. Long Island's own John Brodigan, doing it proud, doing it loud, and doing it just because I owe it to the people. And if you thought last week's episode of The Right Hook was an example of me owing it to the people, get a load of this week. This week is huge. This week is beyond huge. We're going to be talking to a gentleman by the name of Sean Bilott. He's running for Congress in Massachusetts. He ran for Congress last in 2010 against a little-known politician known as Barney Frank. And he's running in the same district because Mr. Frank is retiring. He's running in the same district this year, this time against one member of the Kennedy family who I don't know if you're that familiar with Massachusetts politics, but the Kennedy family is kind of the big effing deal there. Also, and this was great because I'm sure if you listen to this show, you probably subscribe to The Transom. It's an awesome newsletter. It's the only way you should start off every day if you care about politics. Ben Dominich is going to be on, or Dominich. It will to discuss the newsletter, discuss the Wisconsin recall, discuss healthcare, discuss bank capital, and all sorts of good stuff like that. But first, I still can't believe this actually worked because I was able to set up this interview just by emailing info@gop.com. But our boss, the head cheese numero uno, gentleman I like to call Master Priebus just because it makes him sound like a Jedi, making his debut on The Right Hook, and hopefully we're going to have him back many, many times again. Chairman Priebus, welcome to The Right Hook.
Hey, John, thanks for having me.
So, I mainly wanted to focus on the Wisconsin recall and some social media outreach you guys are doing for the 2012 election.
Yep.
But, we really have to start with this Cory Booker thing, and I guess my first question is, on days like today, do you send a fruit basket to the DNC and say, thanks for making it easy?
Yes. Well, I got to tell you, I mean, nothing like getting your key surrogate out on Meet the Press and just having a moment of truth come on. I mean, it was just, it's true. I mean, the reality is what he said is true, and people agree with something that's just reasonable like that, and the mayor said what we're all kind of thinking, like, well, give me a break. I mean, here you got a president, as I've said on a competing show, that, couldn't find his way through the inside of a lemonade stand when it comes to businesses and how they operate, trying to go after Mitt Romney, who has successfully helped hundreds of companies. And the reality is this is about who is going to be the best president for the future. You know, some of these guys that are running for office and the folks around them, I think they just don't focus in on what most voters care about, which is what are you going to do in the future. And And that's what this election's all about.
And I know the GOP, because, you know, in the name of bipartisanship, you guys launched a petition about how we stand with Cory Booker.
Right.
And there's one thing I've really been impressed with the operation the past year or so, is the fact that the turnaround is so good. A lot of times, I don't even see it on the news. I see the response from your Twitter feed.
Yeah,
on average, what's the general turnaround from, you know, you see something in Meet the Press to you guys start tweeting it out?
Well, the tweeting out part comes instantly. I mean, being able to get an actual research document out, like either on Cory Booker, or if I got done with a piece and I, you know, came up with something about the lemonade stand or something like that on the spot, and we need to turn that around through our social media reach and digital reach, we could probably get something out in about under a half an hour that's a decent, good product, and then start working on a web video, and then start working on the other things that we need to do in order to continue to pursue a line of thought. And so on the Cory Booker issue, obviously that happened instantaneously, and why not have a petition to support a moment of truth like that, and to see, you know, we don't want to see Barack Obama and all of his minions, you know, attack poor Cory Booker. And so we at the RNC have decided to come together and protect Mr. Booker from, you know, David Axelrod and Gibbs and all of Obama's minions.
And speaking of social media, you guys, between the web videos, and you guys have launched the Social Victory Center on Facebook.
Yeah.
Is there more of I've noticed a lot more of a focus, and for the longest time we were behind the Democrats when it came to, like, you know, the internet and the computer and you know, stuff that we should have been caught up on. Has there been a conscious effort of to focus more on social media to get our message across?
Absolutely.
And how's it working so far?
Well, I'm probably a little bit obsessed with it. So I would say that you could, I mean, I'm a type of person who, you know, when it comes to Twitter especially, and I should be more so on Facebook, but I'm just addicted to Twitter. I think it's an awesome tool and application. I think that if you set up your news feed in a smart way, you can be ahead, or, I mean, you're just, as you know, you're instantly on top of everything going on. You get instant responses. You know how people are thinking and feeling, which I think is invaluable. And I think that our party needs to be completely and totally plugged into these tools and be on the ahead of the game. And so my view in regard to social media, digital reach, is whatever they can do, we can do better. And one of the things that made it difficult in the beginning, obviously, John, it's not to gossip about the past, but I'll tell you, when you're $25 million in the hole and your party barely has the stamps to put on an envelope to even solicit for money to begin with, you know, these things are tough because, as you know, I mean, you can grow organically, which is always the best thing to do, but when you've got a short cycle and you're $25 million in debt, you have to make smart decisions in social media, like where do I want to spend my money, where am I going to grow the fastest, what tool and what, you know, what place do I get in the social media world that is going to give me the most consumer data, number one, which is important when you need to influence voters. And then the second piece is what's also going to be able to be used in order to bring dollars in the door down the line. And so those are always the two things that you measure. So when we did the Social Victory Centers, we found a place that I think maximized all of those things, which is, it was costly, but it was also something that we could provide people with exclusive information, exclusive data, videos, all those other things, you know, absentee ballots, wherever you're from. We could have you call from home. So if you're in Kansas and you know that it's probably not going to be a targeted state, and it, Lord willing, it won't be for us, but you want to help out in Missouri, or you want to help out, you know, in Pennsylvania, you can get on your Facebook application through a Social Victory Center. You're communicating with all of your friends as to what you're doing, so then they're joining in. But then you can call people from your home through the Facebook application at the Social Victory Center. You can call people in Florida. You can help us influence voters in Pennsylvania. Really easy to use. So, the reason is, you know, a lot of people used to be very caught up in websites. And I'm probably telling you something that you've known for years and years, but there's a lot of people that don't realize that nowadays, spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on a website for us is really a horrible use of money, because people aren't going to, en masse, figure out your own quirky way of doing things on your site, your question, the blocks. What we did was we took the power of Facebook, which is something that most Americans, if they're on the computer, already know how to use, taking a format that they get and understand, and then using that format in order to produce a social media center for the Republican National Committee, that was just the best use of our time and our money. And so far, it's just been like gangbusters, and I expect it to keep going.
And you had mentioned one of the good things with using a social media center, say like someone from New York can help out in like a state like Virginia.
That's right.
One of the states we're focusing on before the election in November is still have the Wisconsin recall going on, which some people might even think is as important as the November election, which you might know a little something about, well, with the fact that you came from Wisconsin and used to be the head of the Republican Party there. I know the polls look good. I know that we had good results on primary night. I know that the endorsement from the Milwaukee General Sentinel is definitely good, but we still have 3 weeks left. What do we need to know going in there to make sure that we keep our eye on the ball and win?
Well, for one thing, voter fraud in Wisconsin runs rampant. So my view is Scott's got to get 52% in order to just be even. So, I mean, you just have to assume that there's going to be voter fraud going on in Wisconsin, and we can't sort of just take it easy, number one. Number two, you know, the unions are going to be out in force, and I think that, you know, being comfortable is not a place we want to be. I think we should be confident in the fact that Walker's reforms are working, people's property taxes are lower, the schools and you know, the teachers are still teaching our kids, and not, you know, the sky hasn't fallen. And that's the hard part the Democrats have, because the sky hasn't fallen and people's property taxes have gone down. And so it's very hard to motivate a base of people telling them that the world has come to an end when they know the world hasn't come to an end. And in fact, things are getting a little better in Wisconsin. Here's the other piece. I think people are sick and tired of folks in politics, quite frankly, on both sides, that love to say one thing and do another. We need people of their word to run for office, real, authentic people, not plastic, real people like Scott Walker. And those folks get rewarded in politics, and I think that's what you're seeing in Wisconsin. The other thing you're seeing is that even Democrats, now we're seeing in poll after poll that not a big percentage, but a decent small percentage, 10% or so, of Democrats that don't intend to support Republicans are saying, look, I'm not even going to be involved because although I don't agree with some of the things that Scott Walker did, I just think this recall business is ridiculous, and I'm not going to be a part of something when, you know, clearly Scott's not doing anything illegal. I just don't agree with the policies, and that's not a proper use of the recall law. So we feel great. I've never heard Governor Walker more confident and strong and articulate than he has been over the last few months, and so I know he'll win. And I think the Democrats are going to have a tremendous fallout, and it's going to help us win Wisconsin for Mitt Romney.
And finally, because I do have a lot of like activists listening to the show who either they've been doing it for a while, they're looking to get their foot in and to get their start. If you could talk a little about your background, how you got started, and what would you say would be the best way for someone else to get started?
Well, you know what I think? I think you have to take every step in your, you know, I've always been kind of like this planner type person. I'm always a goal person. I still am, of course, but I think in politics, what I've learned over the years is that whatever your job is, no matter whether you think, whether you don't want to do it for a long time or whatever the case may be, do whatever you're doing better than anyone else has done it. So if it's organizing the phone banks, which, by the way, 12 years ago, that's what I was doing. I was putting the phone banks together and making sure we had enough phones and enough pizza at the place we were making phone calls for Bush to win his election in 2000. So So my background is, you know, I grew up in a place called Kenosha, Wisconsin. I love politics. My grandfather was Greek, and it's a long story, but he got me really interested in politics. And my dad worked at American Motors, and he was an electrician. And my mom was a realtor. And I just got involved at a young age in politics, just on the county board. I was on the county Republican Party as like just an at-large member and then a secretary. Then my good buddy named Paul Ryan decided to run for Congress, and obviously not a bad buddy to have. But, you know, he won in 98. We didn't know if he was going to win, 28 years old. It was a tough district, but he did, and I was his chairman for years, and then I got involved in the state party, became the chairman eventually, and one of my other good friends was Scott Walker, and obviously he went on to good things, and I went to law school down in Miami. I was fortunate enough to go to school with Marco Rubio when he was in school, you know, kind of one thing led to another, but I would tell you that the whole way through, what I concentrated on the most was doing the best I could possibly do at the time I was doing it, whether I was like college Republican president in undergrad or state party chairman. And I always knew that if I kept my head down and worked hard, that eventually you would rise to the top. And that's kind of what I did here at the RNC too, which was, you know, most people thought, who in the world is a guy named Reince Priebus from Wisconsin chairman? Who is this guy? But over time, I let the work that we were doing tell the narrative. And as long as you were hitting your marks and doing what you were said you were going to do and being functional, operational, watching your mouth, staying on message, eventually people would start to notice that, well, wait a second, the RNC's back. And so I guess that would be my advice. Whatever the job is, keep your head down and work like crazy, and people are going to notice.
All right. Well, Chairman Priebus, thank you for joining us today.
You bet.
We'll keep the boots on the ground for Wisconsin all the way to November, and we will talk to you soon.
Thank you, John. God bless you.
Thank you very much. Yes, that was Chairman Priebus on my little podcast here on the mighty FTR Radio, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Right Hook.
This is Andrew Breitbart, and you're listening to FTR Radio.
I love teaming with the best. That's why I'm here at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. Our research has changed the way the world treats brain tumors, leukemia, and sickle cell. We help kids all across America. Now these kids have hope.
And a sense of humor.
Where'd you get this color?
It's natural.
Give thanks for the healthy kids in your life and give to those who are not. Donate now at stjude.org or shop wherever you see our magnifying glass.
Tired of having feelings? Get rid of those counterproductive emotions of depression, anger, and anxiety. BLI brand medication makes life better. Talk to your doctor today and eliminate all of your problems. BLI brand medication for a better tomorrow.
Once again, now it's getting unbelievable. 'Cause I could not have it better, but I just can't get no play from the girls all around as they search the night for someone to hold on to.
Back. Thank you for keeping it tuned to The Right Hook, which of course you could follow all week on the internets, www.righthookny.com, also facebook.com/The Right Hook, twitter.com/righthookny, and of course the podcast section of the iTunes. Our next guest, and like I said before, if you listen to this show, I guarantee you, you read his newsletter. The Transom has become, if you care about politics, it's the first thing you should read in the morning. Before your comics, before you watch your cartoons, you make yourself a cup of coffee, you read The Transom, you're going to know everything you need to know for the day. Making his debut on the show, and I was very stoked that he agreed to do this. Ben Dominich, welcome to The Right Hook.
Great to be with you.
So, a lot of people over the course of the past year have signed up for something called the Transom. Everyone from like Eric Erickson to even like Ezra Klein and people have like spoken about it, and it's generally everyone's like the first thing they read during when they get up in the morning. Tell us a little about the Transom and what made you start it.
Well, I want to thank you first off for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to anybody who's doing podcasts, doing blog radio, that kind of thing. And so thanks for that. I started the Transom back in August of last year, mostly because I found that there was just two things going on. One was just that there seemed to be a real dearth of any kind of email that was going out in the morning that was really aggregating everything from the right, putting together a lot of different perspective and analysis on things that were going on. And instead we have a bunch of sort of aggregation emails that are produced by places like Politico that just focus on really insidery stuff. And I got tired of reading about the birthdays of people who I didn't know and which consultant got spotted at which restaurant with which sort of B-level celebrity. And instead I wanted to try to see if I could find a venue, a place that I could collect the stuff that was going on online during the day that maybe people who were in positions of importance didn't have the time to track or keep track of during it and put it in a format that could start everybody's day for them. And I started off doing it for free, did it for about 3 or 4 months, and then it got to a point where I decided to charge for it, and a slew of people who had already signed up had gotten hooked, and so they all sort of followed me into that model. And you know, I kind of am of the mind that old media has failed, and that new media is still figuring out how to price things and how to share information. And so this is a little entrepreneurial way that I try to think about a way to do that, and people seem to like it, and it's it pays enough that it's worth my time to do it, and I enjoy doing it, and I'm glad that it's a way that increasingly, you know, a large number of folks, particularly media folks, are starting their day.
And when you do it, I mean, you break two of the cardinal rules that we're told about social. And I mean, for the past 10 years since like internet version of 1.0, the two cardinal rules where it's got to be visually stunning, and your newsletter is just like, you know, paragraphs and links. And no one will pay for content, and don't even bother with ads because no one's going to look at them. Have you been surprised at the response?
You know, it does break a lot of those rules. I'm not really surprised. I know this sounds odd, but, you know, I'm a big fan of sort of the investment newsletter model, which is essentially what I'm trying to create, is something that is sort of a niche product for people who are fully engaged, you know, news junkies, politics junkies, policy junkies, who need to be able to have something that gives them a quick scan of sort of what's going on so they don't miss anything. And I think that, you know, that there are folks who really dive into it. There are folks who like the analysis side of it. But, you know, I certainly appreciate the compliments that have come my way for it, and I hope folks continue to read it. And I think, you know, the fact that people are willing to pay, you know, $1.99 for a month to try it or $20 for the year to get it is a sign that people are more willing to pay for content if they feel like they're getting something that a lot of work goes into and that they feel actually delivers value. You know, I personally subscribe to a couple of things, but you know, I subscribe to Commentary and I subscribe to the Wall Street Journal, and I certainly feel like I get my money's worth from their online content. And I think that, you know, folks are sort of moving in that direction anyway, but we're still trying to figure out how exactly it works. If you can exist on sort of an ad-based thing on news production side, then you might have to do something a little bit different. I think that, you know, a place like BuzzFeed shows that, hey, maybe you really can fund political journalism with cat photos, you know?
God willing. So you got the transom where it's light on frills and heavy on policy, which seems to be a good analogy for a lot of the issues that are popping up during the presidential race. Mm-hmm. Most recently, the past week, when it comes to Romney's time with Bain Capital, everything from, you know, Mitt Romney just comes into town and he destroys jobs across the mm-hmm. board, and the stuff with Cory Booker for the past 2 days. Mm-hmm. And from a policy standpoint, and if you kind of understand a little about the way like venture capitalists work and what Bain does, it makes sense about how they create jobs, but it's easy to attack them on the frills about how, yeah, like, oh, well, they make a lot of money and they take it away from you.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think the Romney team's response has been to that so far? And, I mean, how do we make the case that, like, no, trust us. Venture capitalism is a good thing. Ignore what the guy in the White House has to say.
Well, you know, I think that it's interesting that the White House seems to be, and I think it was either Josh Krasauer at National Journal made the point the other day, that it's odd to see the fact that it seems like Newt Gingrich did a better job making these attacks than the president and his team are doing. And, you know, maybe that's just because Gingrich is good when he's on the attack, or at his best when he's on the attack. But I think that it's certainly true in the sense that in South Carolina, he really – you know, sort of took it to Romney there for about 2 weeks and really got some traction with it. And I think part of the reason for that is that Gingrich was actually making a slightly different argument than the one that they are making in the Bain attacks so far. And they might change it up if they think that it's not working. But I've been a little surprised by how badly they've sort of made that argument. And here's why. I think the real crux of the argument against what Romney did at Bain is not actually the sort of the sad sack workers on camera, even those obviously tug at the heartstrings. I think what strikes at the core of what he did at Bain, and this is something that you could say about a lot of people in the private equity world, is that he was somebody who socialized risk, that he was sort of coming out with the golden, or rather that Bain was coming out with the golden parachute, even in situations where they left underfunded pension plans or if they loaded a company with debt. That's something that, you know, frankly, we have to acknowledge is part of the private equity world and is something that they do and that has negative consequences. Now, I'm not the biggest fan of private equity, but it's part of the market, and this is something that we've decided is worthwhile as a country to continue to have, and I think that that's because we recognize that the good outweighs the bad. But I do think that there are plenty of examples, and I expect that they'll continue to come up, where, you know, they dig up situations like, I think it was GST Technologies, where, you know, that Bain had it for about, you know, 12 years or something along those lines, and then at the end of the day, they paid out dividends twice to people but left an underfunded pension fund that had to get, bailed out by the insurer, by PBGC. And so I think that that's a perfect example of the kind of slightly more sophisticated attack, in the sense that it's attacking him for being a golden parachute guy, rather than being what I think that the Obama folks want to paint him as, which is just a guy who goes out there and destroys jobs just for the heck of it, you know, like he's some kind of big bad wolf, which is ridiculous. You know, the point is just that he's trying to make money. Sometimes making money requires you to fire people, and I think that just about everybody who's in the small business world knows that that's true. I think that what they're less familiar with is the idea that you could walk away from something making a lot of money while investors and while other folks get shafted. I noticed that one of the Politico items today about sort of the second round of the Obama attack on the AMPAD front was pointing out that other investors, you know, walked away with about 0.02 of a cent or something like that, or 0.2 of a cent on the dollar, sorry. And while Bain walked away with $100 million on a $5 million investment. And so I think that sort of criticism is slightly more subtle, and I think it's slightly more difficult to respond to. But I think that so far the White House has been too stupid to actually make that argument. I think that instead they're making one that as Cory Booker shows us, repels even Cory Booker, because it's it sort of lends itself to this idea that, oh, private equity, boo boo boo, you know, it's all horrible and everybody's going to be recoiling from it. I think that it would be more accurate to criticize particular aspects of private equity that are not particularly capitalistic in the traditionally understood sense. But I think that in terms of the way that we see the Obama campaign pursuing so far, they don't understand capitalism, so they don't understand the difference. And they're just going to criticize based on the job losses and hope that it motivates people. I think that what's more likely to happen is that it motivates their base and doesn't really do anything to the independents, who seem to have shifted into a completely winnable way for Romney.
And the other big issue that's probably going to come up, actually it's not probably, it's definitely going to come up, is when it comes to Obamacare versus Romney Care. And while I think the White House was kind of hoping health care may have, you know, gone in the back burner a little bit, the Catholic Church kind of ruined any chance of that happening today when I think about 85 of them decided to file a joint lawsuit.
Yeah.
As we get into the election, there's been some concern, and there was some concern with Romney being a nominee in the first place, is that he can't make an effective attack on Obamacare. I mean, is that true, or is there a way where he can at least, you know, get around it?
I think that the problems with Romney when it comes to Obamacare actually will come after the election if he wins. And here's the way I frame it. I think that the reason that Romney won't be as hampered as other people think is that I think that the Supreme Court at the end of June will strike down the individual mandate. Now, I will add to that, though, I don't think that they're going to strike down the whole law. I do think that they're just going to strike down the mandate and then two parts of the law that go with it, community rating and guaranteed issue, which is what Obama's own Department of Justice said that they ought to do if they strike down the mandate. And I think that once they do that, the mandate, which is the one aspect of this that is the most unpopular and that people view as being the primary shared aspect, even though there are others that are, of course, shared between Romney Care and Obamacare, that issue becomes a little bit more moot. And I think that health care will diminish a little bit as an issue because people won't be quite as angry. They'll feel like the mandate's gone, so they're not as affected. That's actually false. You know, in the fact, you'll see a situation where 80% of the law is still in place and you've still got, you know, all sorts of horrible price controls in it. You've got enormous taxpayer subsidies. You still have the employer mandate. You still have the various mandates to create exchanges. You still have the Independent Payment Advisory Board and numerous other terrible aspects to it. I think that what will happen, though, is that Obama will start talking about all the positive aspects of the bill, pretending as if the mandate wasn't that big of a deal and that we'll fix it after the election or something along those lines, while Romney will harp away at the other aspects of the law, particularly ones that don't have anything in common with Romneycare. And so I think you'll see them both continue to talk about it. It'll just be slightly different in the way they do it. I think the bigger challenge for Romney is going to come after the election, particularly if he ends up in a situation where the Republicans, the Democrats still hold the Senate by, say, one seat, which is perfectly possible according to the latest projections. Romney faces a situation then where, while he's promised to do repeal over and over and over again as a way to compensate, you know, with his conservative base, he's going to face a situation where repeal is virtually impossible. And even if you did it, frankly, through the reconciliation process and were able to get a Democrat to come along with you, the reconciliation process can only really strip out about another half of the bill, because it really only has to deal with the money that's spent, less than the requirements that are placed upon people. And so the upshot of it would be Romney would face a situation where he would have to make Obamacare better, make it more market-friendly, which is something that I think will be anathema to the base, which is insistent on a total repeal, and to many members of the House and Senate, but is not necessarily anathema to the leadership of the Republican Party, and is something that they're already starting to talk about openly. And I think that that's going to be a challenge very early on for Romney should he be elected president, because the base will want him to expend a lot of political capital wiping the whole thing out, but Romney may not want to actually do that. He may want to do his tax reform and other things instead.
Yeah. And before we even get to November, we've got the big recall election in Wisconsin with Governor Walker. And polls have been looking good, and yeah, the great editorial in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. What do you think the main thing we have to focus on for the next 3 weeks to make sure he actually wins? – and, you know, we don't wind up dropping the ball on the one-yard line while we're showboating.
You know, I think Walker has shown, has really proven that he's a savvier operator than people thought, and they've benefited. I mean, the fact is that these reforms have not done the kind of damage that people were, doing all these scare tactics about before. I think that really just if you focus on and continue to focus on the fact that this is a decision that had to be made, these are decisions that had to be made, and we could argue about whether he brought people along sufficiently in the public square before making them. But I think that the general impression of people in Wisconsin is that, you know, these were tough decisions. He's made them. They've done less damage than some of the fear mongers sort of said that they would. And I just don't think I really think that Walker's going to be able to pull it out. I just don't think that he's going to be rejected. Now, there are some longer term ramifications for that. And the fact is that, come November, we'll see whether having Walker still in there is a benefit or a hurt, you know, in terms of how this issue plays. But I think it's one of the most important elections that we're going to see anywhere around the country this year, including everything that's in the House and the Senate. And I think that in terms of the vindication of the when you're facing something like this, you should make the tough decisions and not run from them. I think that Walker really sends a message to other elected Republicans about the way they should approach these kinds of issues.
Well, Ben Domenech, bendomenech.com/transom for subscription info. Thanks for joining us on the show tonight, and we will talk to you soon.
Thanks so much. Pleasure to be with you.
And we'll be right back. You are listening to The Right Hook on the mighty FTR Radio.
This is Andrew Breitbart, and you're listening to FTR Radio.
When you're drinking your overpriced coffee or a Mocha Choco whatever in the Wacko Latte at Starbucks, you ever feel like you're the only conservative in there? That's because you probably are. But don't feel bad, as you can annoy the bejesus out of those pesky Moonbat, New York Times, and Daily Coast reading liberals by reading HoosierAccess.com. At HoosierAccess.com, you can read the latest thought and opinion from conservatives in the crossroads of America. Annoy the Moonbats. Add HoosierAccess.com to your favorites today.
Please stare into the center of the movie Shame. I'm so happy to be alive. Everything is going to be fine. Did I take my medication today? Keep working hard to stay alive. Goodbye.
And you're back to The Right Hook. Our third and final guest of the evening. It's a great young candidate, and we like to get all the good young conservative candidates for you on the show, who is running in, of all places, a conservative running in Massachusetts, in what used to be Barney Frank's seat, and who his Democrat opponent is a member of the Kennedy family. So to say that he has an uphill climb is an understatement. But like I said, it's a great young conservative candidate. He'll make an incredible congressman and making his debut on the show. Sean Bielot, welcome to The Right Hook.
Well, thank you. That the intro music there was Charlie Baker, who ran for governor in Massachusetts last time, used to use that. It's a great song.
Did it work out for him?
Yeah, Nah, not quite. Didn't put him over the top.
Well, this is your first time on the show as a candidate. We give everyone the first same two-part question. Introduce yourself and just why the hell do you want to join Congress?
Yeah, absolutely. Sean, I'm Sean Villette. I'm running for Congress in Massachusetts 4th. The seat is currently going to be open as of next January. It's currently being occupied by Barney Frank. Ran against Barney in 2010. First person to give him a real run for his money since 1982. So it went very well, just not quite as well as we needed it to. I'm a Marine. I spent 4 years on active duty. I've been in the reserve for 10 years now. I have a Master in Public Policy from Harvard and an MBA from Wharton, undergrad at Georgetown. Spent most of the past 10 years in business, helping companies grow and create jobs and do all that good stuff, all the things we need to do to get the economy going again. I've consulted to Fortune 100 companies. I ran a $100 million product line of defense robotics. These are robots used to go after roadside bombs in Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm currently running a small business. And so as I go around this district and I talk to people, the number one issue, bar none, is jobs in the economy. And I think it just makes a lot more sense to send people down to Washington who have that experience. People are going to go down and not make a career of it, but serve a couple of terms and come back. And that's exactly what I intend to do. I'm running because, well, it started in 2010 when I've just been extremely disappointed in leadership from Washington for the past few years, obviously, particularly since the beginning of the Obama administration. And Barney Frank was my representative in Congress, and nobody was stepping forward to challenge him, so I did. And in 2012, this year, there was a sense of unfinished work. And we succeeded in helping Barney to retire, which was the initial goal. After redistricting, the district became much more competitive. And since he had a competitive race last time, I think he decided to step aside. So we had succeeded in that regard, but we hadn't obviously won. And Massachusetts hasn't had a Republican representing them in Congress since 1996. And it's time for, you know, some some new ideas, some fresh thinking for this delegation and in Washington more generally.
And you're running in a state like Massachusetts, which I know from living in New York, it's not exactly friendly towards the Republican Party, which on top of which, first you ran against Barney Frank, and now I believe you're running against a member of the Kennedy family. When you have like all those things working against you, how do you go out and like make the case to voters? And obviously you're gonna have some voters who are gonna vote party line no matter what, but make the case to voters in the middle who may or may not actually be open to like hearing new ideas.
Well, actually, Massachusetts is changing, and you saw that in the Scott Brown election. But success breeds success, and for a long time, people weren't voting Republican here because they weren't seeing strong candidates. And as more and more strong candidates have emerged, more and more people have voted Republican, and you see that also in the new registration numbers. The 2012 registration has drifted a couple points to the right. Democratic registration as a percentage of the total is down slightly. Unenrolled, which is what we call independents here in Massachusetts, are up slightly, and Republicans are up slightly. So people are shifting rightward gradually. And if those are the people who are going through the trouble of changing their registration. So if there's people who are out there taking that action, you know, for every one person who's going into change their registration, there are a couple more people who maybe are changing their voting behavior but not going through the trouble of going down to town hall. So there's definitely a shift, and it's not a seismic shift, it's a slow shift, but there's a movement towards the right. And in Massachusetts, about half the state, depending on the district, 50 to 52% of voters are unenrolled, so they're independents. And for what has essentially been a single-party state, for that large a percentage of the population to not be enrolled as Democrats tells you a little bit about their thinking. It tells you that they are looking for other options and they just haven't seen them. And when we poll and we see the number of ticket splitters, self-identified ticket splitters among likely voters, and we see how those break and we see how unenrolled break, both of those break conservative. And in this new district, in the redrawn fourth district, Like I said, it's a much more level playing field. It's a 50-50 district. The other, there was probably about a 10 at least point Democratic advantage. Now this is more like a 50-50 district. Charlie Baker lost by less than a percentage point. Scott Brown won by almost 10 points. Mary Connaughton, who ran for state auditor, she won by 52-48. So it's a much more balanced district. It's basically a 50-50 district. And people are tired of Kennedy Dame. It just doesn't carry the weight it used to. I've heard that anecdotally over and over as I talk to people around the district. But it also bears out in the polling numbers. When you ask people what they think of the Kennedys, very positive. When you ask them what they think about electing another Kennedy, not nearly as positive. This is a guy who has 2 years of work experience, who never lived in the district till a week before he got in the race. He doesn't have a resume. He's running solely on his name. And I think there's a lot of resentment towards that. So I don't think it's nearly as much of an uphill battle as people outside of the state do. And we've got a great organization from 2010, hundreds of volunteers, good name ID. We've been able to raise money. So I'm very optimistic about this year.
Yeah. And most people agree that the top five campaign issues this year are jobs, the debt, and then jobs again.
I think that's about right.
Yeah. And you had mentioned how you have experience in the private sector creating jobs. You know, the people from Massachusetts elect you Congress. They send you there to actually, you know, improve the economy and, you know, do the people's work. How exactly do you translate that into working in Congress, where it seems to be less about, at least in the past couple of years, less about trying to create jobs or get out of the way so private industry can create jobs, and more about just arguing over an ideology?
Well, that's right, and that is not particularly productive. In the first place, I think if you haven't worked in the private sector, you may believe that government can create jobs. You may believe that people in D.C. are smart enough and probably, you know, you think they're smarter than the average person in America and that they can make the right decisions and they can create jobs through governmental policy. That's just not the case. Anybody who's ever run a small business, anybody who's ever worked in a small business or even a large business understands that the fundamental dynamics of the free market are what create jobs. And so government can certainly do things that will enhance the atmosphere in which businesses are operating, and it can also definitely do things that will make the atmosphere worse, and we've seen way too much of that. I think, though, the larger question of how do you step aside from these ideological head bashing or head butting, I think a lot of it has to do with tone. I think you can work across the aisles. I think you can make inroads with people of at the other end of the political spectrum simply by acting like you would to your next-door neighbor, to the guy across the street, acting like a normal person. Too often you see the tone being extreme. You don't have to compromise your principles to achieve compromise. You have to be able to explain ideas. You have to be able to understand where the other side is coming from, and then you have to figure out ways to move forward from there. And I think it's entirely doable. I don't think partisan rhetoric is helpful on either side of the aisle. Highly partisan rhetoric is helpful on either side of the aisle. I think as a Republican, as a conservative, I have a number of principles which align with the Republican Party as a whole. There are a couple of areas where I probably have differences of opinion. But the idea that we would all always adhere to a party line, I think, isn't particularly useful.
Mm-hmm. And, excuse me, this is your, Ellie, your second one for Congress.
Correct.
If someone listening to the show is considering, like, you know, wanting to get involved in public life, or is considering it, but, you know, they look at stuff like having to deal with, like, you know, party politics and having to deal with machines and having to deal with the money and all this other stuff, what would be some of your advice to someone who might be looking to get more involved in public life and wakes up one morning and decides, you know something, I would like to run for office?
Well, the first thing, my wife and I, in 2010 when we got into this, we had a lot of expectations about what it would be like to run, about how about the attacks and some of the ways people go after you and that sort of thing. And one of the things that was most amazing to both of us is how warm and caring people are. People care about this stuff. You have to step aside. They don't necessarily care about Sean Bielat, but they care about the ideas that we share and that I'm going to take to Washington. And they'll work amazingly hard. There are just so many people who put in so many hours because they care. They care about this country and they care about their future and their kids' futures. And it's really it's moving to see. So I'd say that's one of the definite upsides. You get to see that. You meet a lot of people. You learn about what issues are important in all sorts of places. So even before you get into office, just the process of campaigning itself is rewarding. And I think if you're doing it right, you can bring about change even if you don't win, because you can move the dialogue forward. You can get people talking about issues that matter. And so you may not win in the year you run, but hopefully you've created that discussion and created some momentum around important ideas. I'd say if somebody is interested in getting involved, they should just find the level of office which is a good fit for them and go for it. I think a lot of good can be done, school board and town committee and state rep and state senate. I happen to run for Congress because there's a number of issues I care a lot about that are federal in nature. But when you think about what affects your day-to-day life, in many ways it's things that happen at the municipal and state level. So there's huge impacts you can have at any level, and I think the more good people who step forward and get involved, the better it is for us as a country.
And if people want to find out more information about you, more information about your campaign, volunteer, get involved, send money, what's the best way to do so?
SeanForCongress.com. That's SeanForCongress.com. And we definitely need the help, particularly the financial help. Kennedy, because he's a Kennedy, has been able to raise record amounts of money. And that's the one area where he has an advantage. We don't need to go dollar for dollar. But it does take a lot of money to be competitive. And in 2010, we were fortunate enough to raise about $2.4 million, which is about what we'll need to do again this time. To be competitive. So we definitely need the support. Last time we got it, small dollars from across the country, from across Massachusetts, and we're hoping to do that same thing again. So SeanForCongress.com.
Okay. Well, Sean Bielat, congressional candidate in the state of Massachusetts, running an uphill battle against the Kennedy family and, God willing, a future congressman of Massachusetts. Thanks for joining us on the show. Good luck on the campaign trail, and we'll talk to you soon.
Well, thank you very much.
And that's our show. Thank you to our guest, Chairman Master Priebus from the RNC. Ben Dominich from the Transom and Sean Bielat running in Massachusetts. Before we go, I just want to touch on a serious subject. Even though we like to give each other shit all the time, Mark Warner is actually a very good friend of mine, contrary to what may have you may pick up on Twitter and Facebook. And his pastor was murdered this past weekend in the church parking lot. And I know the community is all distraught. I believe he left behind a wife and at least one child. But if you could, just keep the what's the last name? Keep the Isminger family in your prayers. Stay tuned to Josh Gillespie show, because they have all the information about the memorial services and memorial fund set up. And if you could please check out purchased.org and laminc.org. The first one deals with human trafficking. The second one deals with helping to end AIDS in South Africa, which are two charities that the pastor was involved in. So a prayers go out to the church community. And it's kind of an awkward segue, but that's the show. And we'll see you next week on the next exciting episode of The Right Hook.